to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded May 28th, 2025. While having aided and abetted a modern Holocaust for 599 days, and just as the end's in sight, cracks in the frozen-hearted facade of Western government's solidarity with Israel's sick-making and remorseless depravity are beginning to appear, or at least appear to be appearing, while the Toronto presses still churn out laudatory paragraphs for the colonial entity. Coverage of things like the city's Walk with Israel event, held over the weekend, must now include mention of the awkward genocide the Walkers' efforts in Toronto enthusiastically support. Dave Lindorf is an Izzy Award-winning investigative journalist, author, and founder of the web news site This Can't Be Happening. Dave's book titles include This Can't Be Happening, Resisting the Disintegration of American Democracy, Marketplace Medicine, The Rise of the For-Profit Hospital Chains, Killing Time, an investigation into the death row case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and his latest, Spy for No Country, the story of Ted Hall, the teenage atomic spy who may have saved the world. Dave's latest article at This Can't Be Happening's new Substack site, Is Zionism Losing Its Grip?, invites cautious optimism in what has been the bleakest 20 months period, perhaps, in living memory. Dave Lindorf in the first half. And if you're subject to the Western media mentioned, you likely haven't heard of Donald Trump's assassination attempt against the Russian president. But yes, even as he thunders all acontextual against Vladimir Putin and his army's unaccountable escalation in attacks on Ukraine, there is, as the old saying goes, more to the story. John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears and has, as well as serving as advisor to governments at the highest level, too, been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism. Among Helmer's many book titles are The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Skripal in Prison, and now the freshly released Skripal sequel, Long Live Novichok, The British Poison That Fooled the World. John's recent article at Dances with Bears, MAGA and Mega Turn Mugger, following drone attack on Putin on May 20, Putin hit back at Kiev and Trump declared, "I don't like it at all," fills in the gaps of both the Western media narrative and Donald Trump's cognitive understanding, or lack thereof, behind Russia's retaliatory attacks against Ukraine. John Helmer and Getting Closer to the Backside of America's Proxy War in the second half. But first, Dave Lindorf and Loosing Israel's Hold on the Western World. Maybe. Welcome back to the show, Dave.
Oh, thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, it's always my pleasure, of course. Now, Dave, I'm interested, too, in your piece, Fear of Protesting Trump's March Towards Tyranny is Spreading in the U.S. Can you share a bit about your recent return home to and from Britain?
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, it was encouraging to me personally, because I was allowed to get through the immigration process at, Newark Airport, or was it?
Liberty Airport.
Yeah, Liberty Airport, right. And I was able to get through without any concerns about my having been for 2 years at least on the terrorist watch list, as you know.
Yeah, we talked about that. That was under the former Trump presidency, is that right?
So, all right.
Yeah, what's so old is new again.
Yeah, so I thought, you know, okay, so they could just resurrect that. It disappeared. I wasn't bothered during the Biden administration, but I didn't know what was going to happen when I got there. So I kind of wiped my computer of anything that would be useful to them, you know, in terms of contacts and writings and stuff, so they wouldn't end up absconding with my computer. And there was nothing. I mean, it was I sailed right through. So that was good, but the thing that I noticed was stuff like, for example, you don't see in America now the ubiquitous bumper stickers of protest. They're just not there. And I can't even remember a time like that. I mean, you know, even back when Nixon had his his enemies list and everything, and people knew that they were, you know, being watched and, you know, put on lists and stuff. But people would put on their bumper stickers things like, you know, N-I swastika O-N, right? And, you know, instead of the X. And you're not even seeing anything like that. In the first Trump administration, there were all kinds of anti-Trump bumper stickers, but nothing in my in our suburban home area in Portland. Even Portland, Oregon, which is, you know, the left bank with Washington and California, and there weren't any anti-Trump stickers on cars. Possibly that's because people's cars would be damaged by Trump people. You know, they'd get keyed or worse, broken window, something. But, you know, I think there's more to it than just worrying about retaliation from some whacked right-wing Trump supporter. People are afraid of actual retaliation for things that they do.
Well, that touches on a couple of things, Dave. I mean, first of all, that the automobile is that the ultimate expression of America. And the bumper sticker as the ultimate American expression, the middle finger, if you will, politically speaking, for Americans to wave at one another.
It's really hard to say, but it's true that the car that's seen as synonymous with your freedom in the U.S. And it's part of the reason why Americans are so argumentative in as drivers and quick to anger, because, you know, hey, this is my car and I'm driving it the way I want to drive it, and don't cut me off. It's not happening. I also noticed, like, I had this experience where my Columbia journalism class of 1975 was having their 50th reunion, and the class of 69 had put together a really good protest letter to the administration of the university and to the administration of the journalism school, and they were asking people to sign on to it. And, you know, that's a class that was in the building, as it were, you know, back in 68. And I suggested that we, in our class, sign on, you know, as individuals. And it saved the trouble of having to try to group write something that everybody would agree to, because it had already, that work had been done by the class of 69. So I suggested people, I said, I'm going to sign it. I hope everybody else will. And the mechanics of it were, there were four people in the class who had self-selected to be the organizers of our class's reunion and get together. And so I called them, got in touch with them and said, can I send out this letter from the class of 69 to the class, and ask them then to, you know, send, it has the information on where to send your name and your approval for being included. And they said, oh, we can't do that, you know, because we can't give out people's emails. I said, seriously? This is our class. These are all our schoolmates. And they said, no, we can't do that. But if you send it to us, we'll tell them you're doing it, and then they'll have to get in touch with you. So the result is, of course, everybody wrote me and said, please send me a copy of the letter you're asking me to sign. So
what was the uptake, like, percentage-wise?
It was horrible. It was like six people said, please put my name on it. The rest didn't respond. But I also heard that one person had, who I have to guess who it was, because they wouldn't tell me, told them that he couldn't sign or have anything come to him in his email because he's still working. You know, these are senior journalists, and they're afraid to put their names on a letter to their school administrators. This is really fear. So I got a lot of this, I was hearing all these kinds of fears that people have. And also, you know, it's fear to damage relationships in families. It's just not, people don't express how they're feeling about this.
What I find interesting, though, in your story, especially, Dave, is that, first of all, that you were in journalism school at Columbia, and I'd like to talk a little bit about Columbia and how it works into your more recent article that I want to cover. But as well as being, these are aspiring journalists who, in the way back in the 1975 time, which was a different time than what we see today, they were more liable to have FU bumper stickers on their cars. And the more that the man pushed against them, the more that they in that generation would be determined to push back. And I can say that because, hey, I'm a gray enough beard to remember being around in those days and remembering what it was like then.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it was demonstrable. You'd do that. You'd go to demonstrations, and if there were, cops filming the demonstrations, you'd just give them the finger, and it didn't matter if they filmed you. Now, people are afraid to do that. It's totally different. There's definitely a sense that they're coming after you, or they might come after you.
In comparison to the dire situation that we've seen unfolding, or at least those of us that care to look, because it's available, it's kind of depressing that nobody can stand up. People are either afraid or don't care, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, remember, it's been getting worse in Gaza. And with the Vietnam War, which ran from, it was a major issue as of like 1967, and when the first big march on the Pentagon, to levitate the Pentagon and stuff, where I got arrested and spent a couple of days in the federal Huskow in Virginia. For being, trespassing on the Pentagon Mall, that there were, hundreds of thousands of people coming out then. And that was, 67, all the way through to 74 when it ended. And people didn't get tired of it. People didn't drop away. The protests actually got more intense and militant over that time. The frustration of seeing what was happening was, just drove more people to it. And people who hadn't been old enough to protest in 67 were coming out in 73. So, but now you see people sort of saying, they're getting tired of it. They're just as you say, the participation in these, protests against the U.S. weapons going to, or Canadian weapons going to the IDF are pretty pathetic.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dave Lindorf. Dave's an Izzy Award-winning investigative journalist, author, and founder of the web news site This Can't Be Happening. Dave's book titles include This Can't Be Happening, Resisting the Disintegration of American Democracy, Marketplace Medicine, The Rise of the For-Profit Hospital Chains, Killing Time, An Investigation into the Death Row Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. His latest is Spy for No Country, The Story of Ted Hall, the Teenage Atomic Spy Who May Have Saved the World. In your article, Dave, your more recent article is Zionism Losing Its Grip? These two articles seem, in a sense to me, to be diametrically opposed. Aren't those two things, the Zionist grip on the American jurisprudence, interrelated with the fear that is spreading in throughout America?
No, I understand why you would say that. If people are afraid to criticize because that, to go out and demonstrate against what's happening in Gaza and about the U.S. support for what's going on in Gaza militarily and financially, it is true that they've, for several decades, the Israel lobby, the various groups like AFI, was it AIPAC, AIPAC, the JDL, and B'nai B'rith, and all those various organizations have worked assiduously for several decades to try to get this notion that criticizing Israel is equivalent to anti-Semitism and not to be allowed. And so that effort was making a lot of headway. They're going after the BDS, the boycotts of products made in Gaza and the West Bank and that kind of thing, and getting teachers fired for having supporting BDS, and all of those things are intimidating. And the states have passed laws saying that you can't be a supporter of BDS programs, and teach in a public school. So in a lot of red states, that's the case. So, yes, that's caused a lot of fear. But at the same time, what's happening now is that you're seeing a surprising number of people who had been sort of taking those positions and supporting them, coming out against what Israel is doing in Gaza and in the West Bank, and using the same language even of the people who have been reported to the INS or ICE, and who are now languishing in detention centers pending deportation. Guys like Mahmoud Khalil had not said anything worse than what David Lammy, the foreign affairs minister for the UK, who says that what Israel is doing in Gaza is monstrous, is offending is offensive to the sensibilities of the British people. He's using terms like cleansing, that are cleansing Gaza and genocide. And so if these guys are, and he's not the only one who's doing this, if these guys are saying those same things that we're sending people off to a maximum security prison in El Salvador for, then it can't be possible. You can't do that. So I'm saying that what Netanyahu is doing, and his national security supporters, in the military and his equivalent of the FBI are doing, is destroying all that work of two decades or more of propagandizing to make to opposing Zionism the equivalent of opposing Jews.
Well, in the Columbia Spectator, the newspaper for Columbia University, back on the 10th of April, 2024, I'm looking at an article of Jewish faculty reject the weaponization of anti-Semitism. In that article, or open letter by a couple of dozen staffers or professors there, they say the political passions that arise from conflict in the Middle East may deeply unsettle students, faculty, and staff with opposing views. But feeling uncomfortable is not the same thing as being threatened or discriminated against. Free expression, which is fundamental to both academic inquiry and democracy, necessarily entails exposure to views that may not be deeply disconcerting. I didn't see an open letter by other faculty. Is it only Jews and Jewish professionals like at Columbia that can speak out like this because they're somehow, other than the self-hating label that gets stuck on them, are they deemed the only ones that can say things like that without suffering charges of being anti-Semitic? And then if that's the case, isn't it working? It's just shutting up everybody else.
No, I don't think that's what you're seeing. I think that they are saying those things, but that it's not newsworthy for the ones who are not Jewish if they say that. If it's newsworthy when the Jews are saying it, that and that's why it would make it into the Spectator as an important statement. And I think that what is significant is that a large number of Jews at Columbia are making it known that that's how they feel, and that they feel it's important. And I agree, it is for them to say those things as American Jews. And so that's why it gets in the news in the Spectator. But it's not that other people are afraid to say it.
In your article, A Fear of Protesting, you say only standing firmly against threats to freedom can combat the destruction of our First Amendment rights. I'm looking at a piece in The Guardian that is dated yesterday. A judge strikes down Trump order that targeted U.S. law firm Wilmer Hale. What we've got going on is that as the article goes on, and what I call is three court days in May, where Wilmer Hale is the third white shoe law firm to have been attempted to be shut out of doing business with the Trump administration for whatever reasons that the Trump administration is unhappy with them. They're the third that the courts have turned against these executive orders coming directly from Trump's office doing this. Have you followed this?
Yeah, very closely. And the ones that have stood against it because they're winning cases is a big deal, because that particular case is fantastic, because you know, he made the point that you can't have you can't actually have a rule of law that amounts to anything if you can punish, if lawyers can be punished for the cases that they take pro bono. I mean, the whole idea is that you get these horrible lawyers who are just in it for the money, who are in the U.S. system, they're obligated by their professional guidelines to take pro bono cases of people that don't have any money and need to be defended. And they go, a lot of them actually hire attorneys, young attorneys, and put them on the pro bono cases and just pay them to do the pro bono cases. And that's how people in unpopular situations get defended. And if you punish the law firms who do that, then it won't happen, because the ACLU and the public defenders are so overwhelmed that they could never take all the cases that need to be taken.
Well, to be fair, too, The Guardian just picked that up from the Associated Press, AP News. The article I cited, The Guardian does, Judge Strikes Down Trump Order That Targeted U.S. Law Firm Wilmer Hale, 27th of May. In that article, though, and I'm not sure if it was AP that wrote it or if The Guardian did a little rewrite on their own, but they say, quote, the firms had all been subject to Trump executive orders that sought to impose the same set of consequences, including suspending security clearances of attorneys and barring employees from federal buildings. The orders have been part of a broader effort by Trump to reshape U.S. civil society by targeting perceived adversaries in hopes of extracting concessions from them and bending them to his will. And that was from the order of D.C. federal judge Richard Leon that threw out the third judge to do so in a week, the executive order coming from Trump's. So what that says to me, Dave, is that the pillars of American society, just looking back for a minute on Columbia University and the other Ivy League universities that have seen presidents squeezed out. Do you agree that the pillars of American society are under attack, a systemic attack?
Yes. And these are business interests. Remember, we're talking about big money. Mm-hmm. They're being frozen out of the where their bread and butter is by the threats that Trump makes. And yet a lot of the law firms are standing up now, and because a few of them did. So I think that this is an example of it, kind of. And I guess I see what you mean about it's a contradiction, in the sense that people, ordinary people, are afraid to speak about politics, you know, and to protest. But at the same time, it's true that there is a resistance growing to a blank check for Zionism.
Well, and what we see right now is more than politics. I mean, these are grotesque crimes against humanity that are really unprecedented. We're getting
absolutely.
And people feel powerless over their governments to stop them. And perhaps it's changing, perhaps it isn't. But will anything happen in time to save those that are feeling it most acutely in Gaza and in the neighboring Lebanon, Syria, Libya, all these countries that have been destroyed in the time that you and I have been speaking, this great reversal?
Let's say it. I mean, for one thing, I don't think that there's a chance in hell that Trump is going to get to do his idea of, evacuating or driving out all Palestinians out of Gaza and turning it into a rich people's beachfront playground. That's not going to happen. And I think that's a sign that, I would have thought maybe 4 months ago that could happen. But I think that the resistance has reached a point that I don't think it can happen. Britain is looking at sanctions and working with Canada and France to come up with a group sanction of Israel that would have, real teeth. Look what Netanyahu did. He had the IDF firing bullets over the heads of a diplomatic team that included most of the NATO member countries, and because they said, oh well, they went off the route that we were approved to go on. Well, that's not how you tell diplomats that they're going the wrong way.
Well, I'd like to share your optimism, Dave, but I mean, on Sunday just past, tens of thousands came out in support of Israel in Toronto and marched down the street. And the government there, the municipal government there, enacted so-called bubble zone stuff, actually laws that I first saw being proposed in Britain to limit protest in certain areas, but then there's so many of them and they overlap it, and it's so confusing. It's almost like Israel telling people where it's safe to go in Gaza. Dave, we're out of time. Before we go, though, can you plug This Can't Be Happening Substack site? How do people find your work?
If you just put this can't be happening in a search bar, it'll take you to it. It'll also take you to the old site, which is fine if you want to go there and see the older articles.
You have a vast archive of not just you, but all the whole team of journalists.
That goes back to 2010 and when we founded it. And or you can go to Substack and just, search it in their search bar. This can't be happening.
Well, Dave, it's a joy. There's more, of course, I wanted to talk about, especially the parallels between you and Thomas Wolfe's George Weber, who can't go home again. But we'll save that. You're still in Britain as it stands right now, and we'll see if you do come home again to this side of the Atlantic.
It's an open question.
Okay, Dave, thanks a lot for coming on. Stay tuned. I'm going to be back with John Helmer after the break.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire.
Doge is going in and taking over every department that exists, laying off most of the workers, making sure there's no one that they missed. Nothing that they're doing's constitutional. This doesn't seem to be a concern. They just plow ahead with their agenda. Pretty soon the rest of us will learn. It's a coup. It's a coup. It certainly appears they have dropped the other shoe. They're dismantling the state to make America great. Soon we get to find out if it's true. The policy is